Steve Kinzer, you've written a sort of 50th anniversary account of what looks to me like the original sin in American policy in the Middle East, the overthrow of the man of the century in Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, a popularly elected prime minister, European-trained, rule-of-law sort of Democrat who had the temerity to claim that Iran's oil actually belonged to Iran. I read every word of this book in two sittings, and I honestly didn't know at the end whether to laugh or to cry. 50 years later, we're living in a world that those events created, are we not?
Very much so. I think one of the crucial aspects of the American character is our lack of interest in history. We think that our effects we think that our policies in the world don't have any effect. My book shows that that isn't the case. I'm trying to prove that things that we do in the world as a nation, just like things that we do in our own personal and private lives, have consequences. This is something that Americans are still just beginning to grasp.
Even Dwight Eisenhower, early on, said, no, it would be much better to, with these downtrodden folks, to learn to like them and get them to like us instead of they're hating us forever. And yet somehow we made those choices anyhow.
The United States had never overthrown a government when the British came to us and asked us to overthrow the government of Mossadegh in Iran. Truman's reaction was, we're not in this business. In the first place, the U.S. should not be overthrowing governments of other countries. In the second place, this particular country is one that we don't know very much about. And in the third place, in general, you never know what the long-term consequences are going to be when you interfere so profoundly in the political and cultural development of a foreign country. That turned out to have been very prescient advice. When you intervene so directly in another country, it's a little bit like releasing a wheel at the top of a hill. Hmm. You never know how it's going to roll, what bounces it's going to take, and where it's going to wind up. It's a very dangerous project. And even if it seems like a success at first, which the Iran coup did, over years and even decades, the processes that we set in motion can come back to bite us in very tragic and horrible ways.
Steve, I want you to follow this particular wheel down this particular hill. You say in the book, late on, it's not far-fetched to draw a line from Operation Ajax, which is what the CIA called the destabilization of Iran, through the Shah's repressive regime and the Islamic Revolution of 1979, the Ayatollah Revolution, to the fireballs that engulfed the World Trade Center in New York on the famous 9/11. I'd like you to trace that progress, but maybe you ought to begin with the background of how the British, starting around the turn of the century ago, got their hooks into that oil and tried so hard to cling to it.
In the early years of the 20th century, it became clear to far-sighted people in London, Winston Churchill among them, that a profound revolution was going to reshape the entire world and determine who was going to be on top and who wasn't. And that was the revolution of oil and the internal combustion engine.
Hmm.
The British had no oil in the British Isles, nor did any colony that Britain controlled produce substantial amounts of oil. They were very anxious to get their hands on some of this resource. And when they cast their eyes upon Iran, they found there what Winston Churchill called a prize from fairyland beyond our wildest dreams. They founded what became the largest industrial enterprise in the entire British Empire. That was the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. And for the first half of the 20th century, extracted hundreds of millions of dollars worth of oil from Iran, used that to fuel the economic growth of Britain, and certainly through its supply of the Navy, the military power of Britain. Very, very little of the money that was earned from the sale of that oil ever made it back to Iran. As the years passed, this fact naturally became a source of mounting irritation and anger on the part of the Iranian people. That anger propelled Mohammad Mossadegh to the prime minister's job in 1951. He was an advocate of nationalizing the Anglo-Iranian oil company, and soon after taking office, he carried out that nationalization. This enraged the British. They tried to stage a coup against Mossadegh, but he got wind of what they were doing, closed the British embassy, and sent all British diplomats, and with them all British secret agents, back home to London. That left the British in a very difficult situation. They were losing their oil company, but they didn't have any agents on the ground to carry out their normal reaction, which is to overthrow the government that gives them trouble. They went to the Americans and asked, would you do this for us? Would you go to Iran, please, and overthrow Mossadegh? Harry Truman effectively threw them out of the office and said, we don't do that kind of thing. But in early 1953, President Eisenhower replaced Truman. His administration was much more receptive, and within a few months, the Americans were actively plotting with the British to launch a major operation that resulted in August of 1953 in Mossadegh's overthrow.
You know, among the many resonances today is this sort of Tony Blair, George Bush cooperation in an Anglo-American adventure. In 1953, the Brits were astonishingly blunt and arrogant about saying that basically, you know, we found it, we stole it, we have the fleet to take the oil out of there. The Iranians, in so many words, they said, should be grateful for these little gratuities we tossed them from all this. It's amazing to me, in hindsight, that the United States, even Eisenhower, went along with a nakedly imperial adventure.
I think you have to understand how the world looked then. In a way, it looks a little bit like the way it looks now from the point of view of the people who hold power in Washington.
And London.
It seemed as if a huge international enemy was surrounding the United States. The U.S. is seen in much of the world as the great dominant power, but we often see ourselves as surrounded by enemies and besieged ourselves. Just as we now feel that we face an international enemy, so did the Eisenhower administration. And the threat at that time was actually much more real. We saw China falling to the communists. We saw communist governments emerging in Eastern Europe. We saw the Soviet Union under Stalin developing the atomic bomb. Truman was just as frightened by these developments as anybody else, but he had a very different response to them than the Eisenhower administration later would. His view was nationalism is rising in the world, and what the United States should do is put itself alongside nationalist movements to show people in developing countries that the United States, and not the Soviet Union, was their true friend. This was considered to be too soft an approach by the Republicans. And when they took power in 1953, they were determined to take some steps to show the world that the United States was no longer part of what Vice President Nixon called Dean Acheson's College of Cowardly Communist Containment. What the Eisenhower administration wanted to do was to find some place in the world where they could strike back at communism. Now, it's very interesting how the British recognized this and played on this fear. Even before Eisenhower had been inaugurated, the British sent one of their senior intelligence operatives, a guy who had been the chief of their intelligence station in Tehran before Mossadegh closed it down, to Washington. And he wrote many years later in his memoir, "I knew as I was coming to Washington that it was not going to be effective if I came to the CIA and the incoming State Department officials and said, we British have lost our oil company. Would you Americans please overthrow the government back in Iran so we could get our oil company back?" This was not an argument that was going to be very effective in Washington. So he wrote, "I thought of another approach I could use." Knowing the mindset of Alan Dulles, the CIA director, and his brother John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State, "I'm going to tell them not that Mossadegh is bad because he took away our oil company, but that Mossadegh is bad because the open democratic system that he's trying to implant in Iran opens the way to a communist takeover. And if you want to show the world that you're not tolerating any further expansion of communism, why don't you use Iran as the example? That was the argument that the British used, and the Americans embraced it immediately.
They spun, I mean, the Brits spun Washington like children. I mean, it's astonishing when you look back. Mossadegh was exactly the sort of third world leader that you dream of having. He was well educated, a man of principle, enormously popular, a nationalist. In Iran, he kept the mullahs kind of in check. He was a secularist himself, more like Ataturk than Ayatollah Khomeini. I mean, we would invent somebody like that if we could today, would we not? I mean,
absolutely. Mossadegh is a dream for us now. He was, as you say, a secular liberal who was very anti-communist and profoundly democratic. Now, he had his flaws. He could be very obtuse, and he was difficult to deal with in many ways. He was highly emotional. Nonetheless, he embodied what Iranians wanted. We didn't want what Iranians wanted. And that's why Mossadegh became, in our view, an enemy. But what the mistake we made was to refuse to recognize that he was not a lone madman, as the British portrayed him, but the expression of the national will of the Iranian people. If we had been able to work with him, it's mind-boggling to think how history might have been different. I think that Mossadegh's permanence in office, if he had been allowed to stay in office, might well have led to the establishment of some kind of relatively stable democracy in Iran. How much would that have affected the course of events over the next 50 years?
Instead, we backed the Shah, gave him all sorts of military weapons that he probably didn't need. He established a SAVAK, secret police, torture, repression, all sorts of political rivals. And we were stuck with him until, and loved being stuck with him until 1979.
That gets us back to the question you asked earlier about tracing the root of this particular wheel.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
Years.
There's a line in your book, a lot of history flowed from a single week in Tehran, August 1953. Trace it.
We overthrew the last democratic government Iran ever had. Even that phrase is a strange one to us, because to hear the word Iran and democratic government in the same sentence is mind-boggling to us. But that was a democracy. Now, after we overthrew Mossadegh, we replaced the Shah back on his throne. He ruled with increasing brutality for 25 years and was finally overthrown in an outburst of anger that we call the Islamic Revolution of 1979. That was a revolution that actually had a very broad base, even if the regime that finally emerged from it did not. In some of the protests that led to that explosion of revolution, people actually carried portraits of Mossadegh. I have a photo of one of these protests in my book. Why were they carrying pictures of Mossadegh? They were saying, we want to take our government back to democracy the way it was before the Americans intervened in 1979. Now, the intensity of anger that grew, particularly in fundamentalist religious circles, in the 25 years after the overthrow of Iranian democracy, led to the establishment in Iran of a fanatically anti-Western and anti-American regime that not only preached hatred of the West, but carried out various terrorist attacks against American and Western targets around the world. It also inspired radical fundamentalists in many countries to think, we don't have to be at the margins of politics anymore. We don't have to be little factions or groups on the outskirts of power. We can actually take over whole governments and run countries. This was a formulation that dawned on, among other people, the Taliban in Afghanistan. Mm. And they followed, in some ways, the example that emerged from Iran of establishing a radical fundamentalist state, in this case even more radical than the one in Iran. And it was that regime that gave sanctuary to Osama bin Laden and others who themselves had been radicalized by what they saw as American arrogance in the Middle East. Mm. So although many factors affect the course of history, I think it really is fair to say that the coup that we carried out in 1953 did have an impact in shaping the view of many people in the Middle East and beyond that the United States really isn't interested in democracy. And today, when the United States stands up and says, we favor democracy in Iran,
yeah,
the people of Iran roll their eyes and say, are you kidding? We had a democracy, but you crushed it.
You know, we were so, I don't know, concertedly blind all that time. I mean, I remember Dave Powers, JFK's sort of jester, saying, that's my kind of Shah, when he met the Shah of Iran. And Jimmy Carter went there in the late 70s, not long before the overthrow of the Shah, and said, I can see in the streets how beloved you are among your people. We received the Shah into our country after he was deposed. It's clear in your book that that's what drove the students wild about seizing the American embassy in 79.
It's some part of history that I don't think Americans understood. In 1953, the Shah fled Iran, and CIA agents working inside the U.S. embassy compound in Tehran organized a coup to bring him back. Flash forward 25 years, during 1979. The Shah, once again, the same Shah, is forced to flee Iran. He is admitted into the United States. Of course, the radicals in Tehran, the revolutionaries, are thinking to themselves, history is about to repeat itself. CIA agents working inside the U.S. embassy are going to do the same thing that the previous generation of agents did before. The only way we can prevent this counter coup of bringing the Shah back, the only way we can prevent a repetition of 1953 is by going into that embassy ourselves. We didn't understand any of that then, and we were not only horrified at the attack on our embassy and the seizure of our diplomats, but completely baffled by why anyone would do such a thing. If we had known more about our own history in Iran, we wouldn't have been so surprised.
Right, and the phrase that became famous was America held hostage, which we were in effect, but they were thinking, wait a sec, no, Iran held hostage for 25 years of the Shah's repressive regime. At full disclosure here, the Imperial University, Harvard, gave the Shah an honorary doctorate in 1968, so it wasn't just the government that they conned.
There's an interesting footnote to that. Mossadegh's grandson, who is now an eminent physician in Tehran, who I met while I was there doing my research, actually himself went on to become an undergraduate at Harvard, and he probably just missed being there when the Shah was getting his honorary degree, but you can see Harvard was playing both sides of the fence for the first time ever, of course.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. There's another line in the book where Mossadegh, who was so furiously anti-British, anti-Anglo-Iranian oil company, was speaking about the education of one of his kids, I guess, and he said, and somebody said, well, where will he go? And he said, England, of course. I mean, where else?
It's a very interesting, there's a very interesting moment in my book when Mossadegh comes to the United Nations to present his case, and he essentially engages in a debate with the British ambassador. As the two of them, that is, Prime Minister Mossadegh and the British ambassador to the UN, are leaving the Security Council chambers, the photographers asked them if they would shake hands for the benefit of the press, so they do that, and they had a little exchange. The British ambassador said to Mossadegh, I hope one day our countries can be friends again. And Mossadegh's reply is, we have never had anything against your country. It was the oil company that twisted the policy of your government, and your government allowed itself to be used by the oil company. The oil company is our adversary, not the British people or the British government.
It's so interesting. Steve, we're talking here on the Internet, where we can say anything in the world we want. What strikes me in this story and in the discussion of all of this politics today is how little we say about what's actually going on. I mean, it is such a dangerous thing to say that the war in Iraq was about oil. The British convinced Dwight D. Eisenhower that this wasn't about oil, it was about fighting communism. The level of spin in the conventional, traditional press then and even now, it seems to me utterly fantastic. Your book is, I mean, I should have said at the outset, you're an eminent New York Times reporter. This is very straightforwardly written in the best, in the very best journalistic tradition, and there are others. But why is it so hard to tell the simple truth about what drives American policy in the Middle East, then and now?
We Americans have a very benign view of ourselves. We look around.
Could be called deluded, really.
Well, we look around our own country, and we see that we have an open, free, democratic society. So we assume that all the governments we support in the world must reflect those same values. It's very difficult for us to grasp the fact that in many parts of the world, we have supported leaders who hate everything that America stands for. And we have even helped them to repress and kill people who embrace American ideals. This contradiction is something that is difficult, I think, for Americans to grasp.
Why don't we know more about it? Why doesn't the New York Times and network television tell us more about it? And let me ask you bluntly, I mean, is the Internet blogging by Iranians, by a famous Iraqi during the Iraq War, is this a route around the inhibitions of traditional journalism?
Well, there's no doubt that the Internet is playing a big role in what's happening in Iran.
Talk about it. There are lots of bloggers in Iran.
First of all, for Iranians to express themselves by traditional means is very difficult because of the repressive policies of their regime. But Iranians have become extremely sophisticated about the Internet, not just the Iranians in Iran, but the Iranians outside the country, particularly in the United States, who are very well connected to each other.
Mm.
Therefore, the ferment that you see in Iran right now, the ferment which I think will ultimately lead to the collapse of this present regime, is being fed in no small measure by the Internet.
This is good. I mean, how does it work?
People in Iran are in constant contact not only with each other, but with Iranians outside the country. And when one sees something happening, instantaneously the news of that event can be transmitted to many, many other people. That actually can produce crowds out on the street. It can also produce support for individual initiatives or opposition to particular government projects in ways that would not be otherwise possible. You cannot in Iran start an opposition radio station or an opposition television station. You cannot hold a mass public rally to denounce the idea of Islamic rule. All of this, however, is possible on the Internet, and Iranians have been very quick to grasp that fact.
That's fascinating. Do you have a favorite Iranian site or two or a blogger that sort of clues you into what's really happening?
There's a site in the United States, Iranian.com, which is a sort of a portal to many, many other sites and all sorts of different voices about Iran. So that's a good place to start.
Steve, I don't want to leave anybody in doubt. Your book is a great place for anybody to start. It's called All the Shah's Men, an American coup and the roots of Middle East terror, going back to the CIA overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh in August of 1953. It's a terrific book. My only concern, Steve, is that it's not going to get enough circulation. I mean, I had to, in the best bookstore in Cambridge, it was just kind of lonely on a back shelf, and it should be out on the, you know, out on the front shelf everywhere.
Well, you're doing your part. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.